May it please the court, Andrew Roth on behalf of the steelworkers and the individual pension plan participants, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I may. I'd also like to begin with the court's indulgence with the standard of review issue. In the Firestone case, the Supreme Court dealt with the issue of what is the appropriate standard of review when a plan administrator makes a benefit eligibility determination based on an interpretation of the plan documents. And the Supreme Court started out in Firestone and they said, ERISA is silent on this question. Section 1132, which is gives the cause of action, does not address that question. There's a gap in the statute. So what did the court do? It looked to indicia of congressional intent in ERISA in determining what that appropriate standard of review was, and it concluded that barring the circumstance where discretion is afforded to the plan administrator, the standard of review is de novo. And what was the court's reasoning in that regard? The court said, well, in adopting ERISA, Congress incorporated trust principles. Under standard trust law principles, you don't defer to one party's interpretation of a contract, of a plan document. It's up to the court to be the referee, decide what that, applying de novo review, what that plan document means, if the pensioner is eligible or not eligible.
And I have to confess, I have a great deal of difficulty understanding exactly what the what you see as the interpretation of the plan here. What is the interpretation?
The interpretation is what the appeals board stated very clearly. The requirement for eligibility for a shutdown benefit is that there be a permanent shutdown of the facility.
And you disagree with that interpretation?
Well, we disagree with the interpretation that on the facts of this case there wasn't a permanent shutdown.
But what's your definition of a permanent shutdown?
Definition of a permanent shutdown, you can't define it in the abstract. You have to look at the course of, this arose under a steelworkers pension plan, a collectively bargained pension plan.
What's your definition of a permanent shutdown?
I thought it was a, quote, abandons all reasonable hope of resuming operations.
Yes.
Isn't that what you said?
But that's the same as Pension Guarantee Corporation's definition.
Well,
so the difference between you two, between the two sides, is a question whether the facts of this case demonstrate that there has been a plant shutdown as defined. And I think I just don't see the disagreement between you and your opponent on that definition.
Well, I think there are definitions at a high level of abstraction, and there are definitions that I think. So at a high level of abstraction, I think there is an agreement between the parties. But beyond that, there is no agreement. I mean,
So I'll tell you where I'm trying to lead this.
Yes.
Is that if what I've said so far is true, then this argument about whether it's arbitrary, capricious, or substantial evidence and kind of disappears, because we have held, our court has held, that arbitrary in this particular kind of context. There's a case called Association Data Processing, an opinion by Judge Ginsburg, that in this particular context, arbitrary and capricious means the same thing as substantial evidence. How do we have a standard of review difficult or question here at all if what we're dealing with is a factual determination?
Well, because I think the art of interpreting a contract is not just saying what, you know, the definition is. It's how do you apply the contract under the facts. I mean, I think that that in a broad sense is an interpretive question that courts deal with when they're reading. That's part of interpretation is what do these words mean, but part of interpretation is also how do a certain set of facts, how does that phrase. How is it to be interpreted in that particular factual context?
Well,
and I think there's a critical disagreement.
You're saying that should be de novo also?
Absolutely.
Well, you cite as your best case, I think, really, Local Union 1395, right?
Well,
that's the example of the case where we've held under that statute that de novo review for the terms, correct?
I think we haven't cited that case as sort of, because I would concede that that case was, you know, the circumstances in which the court held that de novo was appropriate were very different than the circumstances here. So we cite that case only by illustrating the principle that also was illustrated by the National Fuel decision, the subsequent decision, that when you're deciding in a particular context what the appropriate standard of review is, you ultimately have to look to congressional intent. And the
That's a case in which we said that with respect to the terms of the agreement, it would be reviewed, we would review de novo. And that's what you're asking us to do here. But that case also said that deference is extended to the board's factual findings on matters bearing on the intent of the parties. And then it applied a substantial evidence test. This is just to follow up what Judge Randolph is asking you, which is this court must respect the board's findings of fact if supported by substantial evidence with respect to the intent that was expressed outside of the four corners of the agreement with respect to the events that actually occurred. And that seemed like what the district court was also saying in this case, because in footnote 13, she says, the plaintiffs are correct that while an agency has provided deference in interpretation of its own statute, it has not provided deference in matters of contract interpretation. Here, however, whether a permanent shutdown occurred is primarily a factual question, which is within the agency's expertise to determine after review of relevant facts and circumstances.
Here's how I'd address that, Judge Garland. I think the definition, and in response to Judge Randolph, the definition of permanent shutdown, I think there is an agreement on a broad level. Is there a reasonable prospect of opening up the operations? But there's more to that concept legally than that. As the arbitration decisions that we've relied on show, what do you look at to determine, as a matter of law, what are the pertinent considerations when the parties contract? What do they mean by that? And the critical factor is whether the plant was maintained in standby operating condition. That's not a fact. That's what the contract means. Is that a salient legal concept? And there they give the back of the hand to that. That's where the disagreement is, and that's where we say de novo review is critical to say, no, that is how you read this contract. Now, the contract, to be sure, doesn't explicitly define permanent shutdown. But as we've argued,
why not? Why don't the contracts define that?
Because it's, first of all, it's an elusive concept. It is hard to define. And I think it's reasonable for contracting parties acting against the backdrop of 50. Remember, this is a collectively bargained pension plan. It doesn't define permanent shutdown, but it says that disputes over whether there have been a permanent shutdown are to go to arbitration. So I think the parties reasonably understand and presume when they enter into this contract that that term will be defined, given legal meaning, by reference to these arbitration decisions that have given shape to that concept.
Not much shape.
Oh, I disagree.
Thrown in the towel.
That's at a broad level. That's true. But the cases they explicate on that by saying, well, what do we look at in determining whether that standard has been met? The critical factor in every one of the cases, the arbitration cases that we've cited, and usually the employer wins because the employer has taken steps to maintain the facility in standby operating condition. Almost every case we've cited was an employer victory. The one case that we won was in the Republic Steel case, when that the opposite was true. The employer did not maintain the plant in standby condition. That's not a factual dispute. The core of the disagreement between the parties here is the legal relevance of that maintaining and standby operating condition concept.
Right, I agree that's more legal.
Then yes, I would agree that when you're deciding whether there's enough evidence in the record to show whether it was maintained in standby operating condition, that's a factual issue.
So you have a variety of things you've pointed to, the Warn Act notice, the Trade Adjustment Assistance application.
Actually, those are secondary considerations that we pointed to, Your Honor. The chief consideration we pointed to is the company's actions, not its words. Mm-hmm. The company shuttered that facility.
The words help you in the Trade Adjustment Assistance.
I'm not backing away from the words. I'm saying our primary argument is that the arbitration decisions say what's more important are the company's actions, not its words. The words here confirm the company's actions. What the companies did, though, was from May 15th to June 15th, they dismantled that plant. They and in contrast to what they had done in every prior temporary shutdown.
They're still looking for a seller and customers at that point.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that because I was looking at the evidence, the so-called evidence that the PBGC gave for saying they were still looking at customers. They cite this in their brief at...
Maybe hoping's a better word. They're hoping for customers.
Well, I think that even overstates it to say that they were actively looking. I mean, at the point where they actually made the final decision to shutter the plant. In their brief, they say the evidence, it's replete with evidence of that, pages 34 to 35 in their brief. And what do they cite? For this fact, they cite the June 6th email, which is set out at pages 336 and 337 of the appendix. Okay? The June 6th email, first of all, is just rank hearsay. It quotes what the controller of the company said. And then, quoting the company, this is on June 6th, the company has so far resisted declaring a permanent shutdown because there's a glimmer of hope they can survive. And then they say it's about a 10% chance they might be able to sell pellets. So this is on June 6th. Now, the affidavits of the people who dismantled the plant say the actual dismantling took place between May 15th and June 5th, and about June 15th. Mm-hmm. So even giving that hearsay the benefit of the doubt, and then the affidavits are...
Dismantling didn't mean that the plants couldn't come back into operation, because we know it did, right?
Well, no, that's a misnomer. The plant didn't come back in operation. Well, the plant came back in operation under new management.
Exactly.
Only after the company...
They didn't destroy the property, for example.
Well, they maintained it at...
They maintained it in a way that it could be...
They made sure that fire and flood didn't destroy the plant, so in the 10% chance that some buyer would come around, they would be able to sell it.
Did they sell any of the equipment?
They sold all their assets.
I mean, period of time, they weren't selling off the various pieces of equipment.
Not as far as the record shows, but they under the requirement of the asset sale, they had to spend $6 million to refurbish that plant. A company that has a reasonable expectation of resuming operations at their plant, I would submit, does not dismantle it to the point where if it ends up having if it ends up fortunately being able to sell the property, it has to completely refurbish it at a whopping cost. Company doesn't act that way, and the evidence shows it didn't act that way.
What about the fact that they're in Chapter 11, not Chapter 7 at that point? So they're looking to reorganize, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt they were looking to keep their options open. But the notion that they, given the actions they took and given their words, which I do think confirm their actions, they said at the very outset in February to the union, look, if we can't come up with some alternative arrangement, in the Warnack notice, if we can't get contracts in place by the shutdown.
So what was the shutdown on the Warnack notice?
Yeah.
Which is at JA-304, temporary but only if anticipated pellet orders are received during the shutdown period.
There's a little ambiguity there, but I think
ask my question.
Yeah, sure.
What is the shutdown period?
I think there was some uncertainty there. I think what the reference was during the period of time when we are going to be shutting down this plant, if some miracle doesn't happen. And that's why I think that June 6th date is critical. That was the latest reference to some glimmer of hope.
On what date did permanent shutdown occur in your view?
I think it started, I mean, they started shutting down the facility on May 15th. I think according to the affidavits of the two people, it's at JA 299 to 300, I believe, that the four people who were remaining who filed affidavits, they said it took about 30 days to actually accomplish the full shutdown of the plant. So I think that's the shutdown period. And I think the company was holding out hope within that period that maybe some miracle would happen, but it didn't. And they then shuttered the plant to the point of welding doors.
So yeah, there was a shutdown. My problem in trying to figure this case out, and I find it a difficult case, is we all know there was a shutdown, but the word permanent is a elusive word.
It is, and that's
life
where,
and in this contract,
that's where the that's where we submit the course of dealing and the arbitration decisions are relevant, which the PBGC gave the complete back of the hand to. They give some ballast to that concept.
Which fact?
Go ahead.
You answered my question about the difference between law and facts,
yes,
in a way that I thought was helpful. If you reject certain factors as not relevant, that might be considered law.
Yes.
And you mentioned one of them, which was the standby conditions.
Yes.
What other ones?
I think that's the critical one, Your Honor, because that was, if you read the PBGC Appeals Board decision, the linchpin of their decision is they say, well, the fact that it was not kept in standby condition is irrelevant because the facts in this case speak for themselves. 6 months later, another company came in and resumed operations. And that's the way they sloughed off the standby. So that's the critical disagreement. They gave that the shortest shrift possible by latching on to what I would submit as a total irrelevancy.
So when you say that they didn't pay attention to the arbitration decisions, is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about something else? What law element of the arbitration decision?
That would be the critical law element, Your Honor.
What was the selling price?
I think it was like $500,000. I think, but the critical thing that the company got was the assumption of liabilities. I believe, if I recall, the bank.
What was that worth?
There's nothing in the record that indicates how many, but millions of dollars. I think that was the consideration that the company got. There were a lot of environmental and other liabilities there.
And what happened to the workers?
The record, again, is very spartan on that. It looks like
something that most of them ended up working.
I think it's fair to say that most of them did get rehired.
Right.
But, again, I would submit to you that is an irrelevancy.
I agree that's an irrelevancy, but I was just interested in knowing whether they are out.
I think about, as far as the record shows, about 350 out of the 450, but the record's unclear in terms of how many salaried versus hourly in that total.
Right, they presumably got lower benefits, maybe lower salaries.
Well, they didn't. There was no pension plan, for example. The
yeah.
pension plan was not assumed. But under the contract, a permanent shutdown, once it takes place, under the PBGC's own definition, the benefit becomes payable, and it's irrelevant.
Congress has changed this since then, right?
I'm not aware of that.
The 2006 Act hasn't the whole shutdown benefit. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I thought there had been changes.
That may be. I'm not aware of that either.
That's
way.
The problems this was creating for the PBGC. I guess I should ask them about that, though. I will.
Okay. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Roth. We'll hear from Mr. Cooper.
May it please the court. Kenneth Cooper on behalf of the Appalee Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. There is no interpretation to be made of the term permanent shutdown. One can only do it in a particular case based on the specific facts and circumstances of that case. Here,
well,
that's...
Can't you either accept or reject the proposition that failure to maintain the place, to place the plant on standby is a relevant issue? Isn't that a law question or a interpretation question? Why is that a fact question?
That's a fact question because the company follows a certain protocol that they determined they needed in this particular situation.
Well, it's a fact as to whether or not they placed the plant on standby, but it's not a fact as to whether that's a relevant element of the definition of shutdown, is it?
There is no definition, so it is not.
You're telling us we have to come up with a definition, right? I mean, we should defer to your definition, right?
You should defer to the specific determination that was made in this case.
Without any definition at all? You have to have some definition, don't you?
Well, I think you can look at what happened. There was a progression of activity that happened here that shows that there was no permanent shutdown. After the WARN Act notice is issued saying that the shutdown would be permanent. I'm sorry, the shutdown would be temporary unless anticipated orders were received. Immediately after the May 17th, the actual stopping of production at the plant, the management began active engagement in trying to obtain the new orders. And
but that, suppose there was a 1 in 100 chance that that would succeed. So they shut the plant down, and they have a 1 in 100 chance of finding customers or a buyer. Is the shutdown permanent then? How do we, I guess I'm following up on Judge Carlin's question. I'd like to have some more meat on the bones of what's permanent. And I just can't tell what the appeals counsel thought on that. They phrased the general standard of shutdown, what's JA 125, shutdown benefit, resulting in a loss of jobs that is expected to be permanent for all or substantially all of the employees. Well, is it expected to be permanent if you're casting about for customers but you don't think you're going to get any? I think there it's more likely than not expected to be permanent, right?
I think when you have realistic chance, I mean, they were taking activities to they were talking with at least six different companies about mm-hmm. either selling the company or getting new orders. They had a meeting with the congressman in which he suggested a particular route that they pursue with a Chinese company, and then they followed up with that and eventually sold it to that Chinese company on a joint offer basis with another U.S. company.
All that looked pretty bleak. Suppose it was instead of 1 in 100. Suppose there was a 1 in 4 chance that that would work out at the time that all this happened. So under the definition that's put forth by the Appeals Council, resulting in a loss of jobs that is expected to be permanent. If it's a 3 in 4 chance that it's not going anywhere, and a 1 in 4 chance that there is going to be a buyer, is that expected to be permanent or not?
I don't think at that point you could measure what the expectation was. You could, in specific statistical terms like that, I mean, I think you have to look at, as the appeals board did and as the district court said they did.
What you're describing is really that in the common law tradition where courts did not set down a firm rule, but simply, and you would not be able to really discern the rule unless you looked at a whole series of decisions over a period of time and then a rule gets formulated. But I think you kind of got off the wrong track here by saying that there is no definition of what a permanent shutdown is. There is, whether the board says it or doesn't say it, implicit in the decision is that there's some sort of standards that are being applied. But the problem, I guess, that I have is I don't see what the difference is between your side and the union side. It seems to me that nobody's really coming up with any huge controversy about what a permanent shutdown is. And to put the question about the standby into perspective, and one way of looking at it is that this shutdown was different than the prior shutdowns, but all that means is that the management expected this shutdown to last longer than the prior, not that they were totally abandoning all expectation that the plant would be able to start up again. And I just don't understand how we can, as a reviewing court, get a grip on that and say that the board was wrong on this.
Well, it is correct. They did not dismantle the plant, and I think it's right that it depended upon what they thought would happen in this particular case.
Is this an objective question or is it subjective?
It has to be subjective, because as you say,
whose intent or expectation matters.
It would be the management's expectation matters, because they're the ones who can go out, engage in the activity to get the new orders, and pursue the sale of the business.
Is this a public company?
No, it was not.
What if they have an unrealistically, maybe this is too hypothetical, an unrealistically positive assessment, but there's really no chance?
I think if you had gotten to a certain point in the year later that, you know, and they had said, well, we maybe in the spring we can start up again and get some new customers, I think then you start questioning what the chance would be.
So time's important, obviously.
Yes.
I guess just as a matter of common sense. On the WARN Act notice and the Trade Adjustment Assistance notice are not helpful to you. I think the WARN Act notice is somewhat ambiguous, but the Trade Adjustment Assistance letter says it's totally shut down, right?
But totally was an accurate description. There was no production going on at the plant at that time. That said nothing about when it would come back up, the expectations of it coming back up. And I think the WARN Act notice was, it said it's temporary.
Yeah.
What was the $6 million spent? What did they do to get the plant shaped up again?
A lot of it, at least $3 million of it, was maintenance, repairs that would have had to have been made but were deferred. Building up the cooler, repairs to the furnace. I think the majority of it was things that would have had to have been done anyway.
If this, if there were still a plant administrator, and if it hadn't gone to the PBGC, we might have to make all these decisions ourselves anyway, right? Either de novo, if there was no discretion given to the administrator, or with deferential review if there was under Firestone, right?
No, that's not.
Why not?
That's not the case.
It's not this case, but couldn't there be a case where there was a shutdown and a plant administrator still there, and it had not gone over to the PBGC?
That could happen. I mean,
right.
Typically, when you get to that point, more often than not, it's coming to the PBGC. And
does it have to be every plant? This is a plant shutdown, right?
Yes.
So if a company has multiple plants, what happens?
Yeah, that might be something that the plant administrator would have to.
As long as the company doesn't go under and the whole plan doesn't go under and just one plant goes under, wouldn't that then be up to the court to make these decisions, one either deferentially or de novo?
If it was by the plant administrator, then it would be under Firestone, yes. It would be de novo unless the...
Right.
And
however difficult this might be, there are circumstances where we would have to make all these decisions.
With an ongoing plant administrator under Firestone, yes.
Factual, too?
I think it is all factual, yes.
Do we review the factual determinations of a plant? What, does a plant administrator make factual determinations?
Well, they decide whether to give benefits, right?
Yes, they decide whether to give benefits.
And if there's a dispute, it goes to arbitration?
Not in this particular plan, that's what it provided for. In at least the vast majority of plans outside the steel industry, anyway, there is no arbitration component.
But what sort of deference do the courts give any deference to the determinations of fact by a plant administrator?
I'm not familiar with enough decisions in that area, but again, it depends upon the provisions of the plan in terms of how much discretion they're going to get.
Do agreements, as far as you're aware, commonly use the phrase permanent shutdown without further definition? Is this a widespread problem?
Yes, as far as I'm aware, that they use the term permanent shutdown with any specific definition of what permanent is.
And so if you were to lose this case, what are the implications for the PBGC ripple effects, if any? I guess it depends how you lose, but suppose you lost.
I think the implications legally, again, in future cases.
How many cases are out there like this? And I guess folded into that, am I right that Congress changed this in 06?
Congress changed it in 06 to the extent
plans going forward.
Going forward, starting from 06, on August of 06. There's the concept of phase-in of benefits, and the shutdown benefits are in the plan for years and years. Under Title IV of ERISA, benefits are phased in over 5 years. Mm-hmm. What the new law is doing is it's saying the phase-in begins on the date of the shutdown. So effectively, when it occurs, none of the benefit is going to be phased in and wouldn't be payable. And then it would be payable 20% the next year and so forth. But the
Maybe this will help. I thought under the new law, the case like this, clearly there would be no benefits paid. Is that correct? Because I thought there was a time period that had to be triggered before. I thought it was a one-year time period. I could be misreading it, though. You know more than I.
I think you can look at it that way, that there would have had to been 1 year from the shutdown to the termination date in order to have a portion, 20% of
it. That's how I read the new law.
Yes.
And this kind of issue, is Congress was very concerned about the what the PBGC was taking on, and therefore there was a lot of negotiation to get rid of this kind of issue going forward. But going backwards, my question still remains, though, how many cases, how much money is at stake? Do you have any idea?
Presently, I don't know.
Okay.
Well, are you the trustee of any plans that where there's been a permanent shutdown beside this one?
There have been over the years. Well,
pending, I think Judge Kavanaugh is asking what's pending.
Pending at this time, I'm not aware of.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Does Mr. Roth have time left? We'll give you another 2 minutes, Mr. Roth.
Yeah, just three quick points, if I may. In terms of Judge Randolph's comment about you're not seeing a fundamental disagreement, I guess I would fundamentally disagree with that. If you look at pages 127 to 28 of the Joint Appendix, where they reject what they call our allegation that the plant wasn't put on standby, they don't say that's not true as a factual matter. I mean, there's no way to dispute that as a factual matter. The record.
So your definition of a permanent shutdown is if a plant isn't put on standby?
Well, I think that's the definition of a permanent shutdown is where the employer's actions and words taken in together demonstrate that the company has no reasonable expectations of resuming operations at the plant. Critical to that determination, as the arbitration decisions reflect, is it's not conclusive, but it's a critical factor, is the company's actions in placing or not placing the plant in standby operating condition. And in rejecting that part of our case, at page 127, 128, they don't dispute the facts. They say, well, that fact is not controlling here because 6 months later, a new company came in and what they call resumed. I don't see how a new company can resume operations at a plant it never owned. But they're treating it as a resumption of operations by the employer. Negates the permanent shutdown.
They don't say it's irrelevant, yeah. They don't say it's irrelevant. They just say.
But they treat it as irrelevant, Your Honor. And they treat it as irrelevant on what I would argue is a totally irrelevant ground.
They say that such a failure doesn't foreclose any reasonable likelihood of resuming operations.
Right, and then they go on to say.
You disagree with that?
Would it foreclose any reason? No, I don't think it would foreclose, but it would certainly illustrate that the company does not have a reasonable expectation. And that's where the nub of the matter is, because they treat it as not foreclosing, And the evidence that it didn't foreclose is that a new company purchased the assets.
No. That's not what they're saying. There's lots of activity going on in June, trying. The congressman was involved. Other activities were involved. In June.
But that's my point. The shutdown started on May 15th. It ended on June 15th. And there's no evidence. They don't point to anything. They keep saying, well, they cite that email as evidence that the negotiations were ongoing with the Chinese company for all that seven-month period. The email doesn't say that.
I don't see why the standby shutdown versus the more dismantled shutdown makes a difference in terms of your expectation. There may be other reasons why you'd keep it in standby operation.
Well, maybe I'm understating our case then, Your Honor, because it wasn't that they only didn't keep it in standby operating condition. They welded the plant shut. I mean, they literally, I mean, in every sense of the term, they shuttered that facility.
But that's totally consistent with wanting to resume operations. What they didn't want was somebody, vandals, coming in there and ruining their equipment.
Well, but I mean, they welded the door shut. They terminated all the vendor leases, and every step they took, from the vendor leases to taking the batteries out of the cars, I mean, to everything, was in marked contrast to everything they did in four or five other circumstances where they temporarily shut down the plant.
Anticipated this temporary shutdown to be longer than the prior temporary shutdown.
Well. Let me end with, you asked a question, Your Honor, about what they did, what the $6 million was spent on.
You're right.
And that's it's at JA 30. Only less than $1 million of the $6 million was on what they labeled as maintenance. The bulk of the money, $3 million, was on major repair, including furnace rebuild. Another $250,000 on crusher rebuild. And another part of the not keeping it in standby condition was in every time they had a temporary shutdown, they rotated the kilns, they rotated the furnaces so that it wouldn't require that kind of major rehabilitation once. So if they had an expectation of resuming operations, I would submit they would not have not kept basic maintenance of the furnace going on in that plant.
How long does it take for the, is there any evidence here about how long it takes to get the furnaces up to temperature after shutting them down?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. The only thing I can say is it took. I think the sale took place in October, and the plant was up and running in December. I mean, it was not a minor operation.
Oh, I understand that. That's what I was asking.
Given how much money's involved, why don't the contracts define this term more specifically? I asked this before, but there's a lot of money and a lot of lives that are going to be badly affected on something like this, and to just punt in the contract, is that happens?
I just don't view it as a punt because I think that's actually labor relations.
You're here, so by definition a punt. We wouldn't be here if.
Yeah, but that's sort of the nature of collective bargaining. I mean, you know, there are 8-10 different kinds of pensions provided here.
I mean,
when you're engaging in collective bargaining, you're dealing with pension issues, you're dealing with health care issues. I mean, it's impossible.
No.
It's impossible actually to get sort of an agreement on every definitional point that you ideally would like to. And this, when you're dealing against the backdrop of decades worth of arbitration decisions that give, I think it's a fair assumption, as we said in our brief, to say that when the parties don't define it, they're intending to incorporate that body of law that's developed between the parties over the course of those decades. And I think that presumption is particularly apt here, because usually these things don't go to arbitration. The plan administrator does it. But here the parties dictated that eligibility, not everything under the plan, but eligibility determinations would be subject to arbitration. And I would submit that they did that because they assumed that an arbitrator applying the precedent that had been developed over 10 years would give the kind of content to permanent shutdown that the parties mutually intended. I mean, it's just impractical in the collective bargaining context to hold the parties to, you know, sort of every last definitional term.
I agree, totally. I was just asking on this term in particular.
That's the...
Let me ask you about, there's one paragraph I wasn't sure whether this might also reflect, quote, legal decision. It's a J129. Given the fact that, this is from the opinion, given the fact that most T-Bird employees were rehired by United, and assuming that those employees are doing the same or similar jobs, it would be difficult for the board to conclude that a permanent shutdown of the Eveleth Taconite plant occurred at all. Now, I assume you disagree with that.
Yeah, and I think the PBGC, even in their brief, they disagree with that. At the end of their brief, they say, well, the permanent shutdown didn't occur until later. So I don't think they even buy into that. But I do think that is actually another sort of logical or legal flaw that sort of infects this decision. It wasn't factored into the actual decision making, but I think
it wasn't because it goes on with the discussion part.
They didn't make reference to the fact that a good portion of the employees were rehired. But I think the fact that they recited that and made the additional point that shed doubt on whether there ever was a permanent shutdown, I certainly think that arguably infected the decision as well from a legal standpoint.
Further questions? We'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much.
What's up with these? What are those?
Shocks you if you.